Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was investigating the trees in her yard and their abilities to defend themselves against attack. We resume Suburban Safari on page 161 with episode 16. Backyard trees face special challenges related to their urban lifestyle, but they reap benefits too. Paradoxically, town trees are often the tallest around. Just ask my crows. Kevin McGowan, the Cornell Crow Man, has proposed that the size of the trees is one of the amenities that tempts crows into town. Initially, I thought it odd that town trees would be bigger than free-range trees. But there are logical reasons for the difference. One is that town trees don't get chopped down to make paper and plywood. These days, some of the oldest old-growth forest grows in parks and old neighborhoods. Street trees and backyard trees also enjoy reduced competition. They're seldom crowded together to fight over light and water, as forest trees are. Like my oak, a city tree can grow a broad, efficient crown. Being isolated from its peers, it's also less likely to be caught in a plague of caterpillars or a viral epidemic. The town tree even gets a helping hand from the town's dirty air. My car engine puffs nitrogen, and a zillion other things, into the air as I go about my errands. Nitrogen can be a poison or a fertilizer, depending on your perspective. From the poison perspective, the nitrogen joins droplets of atmospheric moisture, which becomes acid rain. That harms plants. And nitrogenous rain can feed the algae in lakes and ponds, which stresses other water dwellers. But nitrogen is also the classic fertilizer chemical. To a tree like my oak, who gets no fertilizer from me, nitrogen that arrives in the rain may be just what the doctor ordered. My tree can even get this shot in the arm from a rainless wind by straining out droplets too small to fall on their own. When flowing air slides up against that wall of oak leaves, the gas molecules change direction and climb over the tree. But microscopic droplets splatter. Scientists from the Institute for Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, have measured the amount of airborne nitrogen that splats on forest edges versus the interiors. The bonus at the edges is huge. Those trees get 1.5 times as much nitrate as the interior trees. The research was done on big chunks of field and forest and focused on the edge effects produced by a line of trees rather than a singleton. But smaller edge effects are rampant in the cities and suburbs where microforest meets microfield. Every edge forces the wind to switch direction. Of course, this nitrogen fertilizer from tailpipes is only a boon if the lawn isn't already stewing in commercial plant food. The dose makes the poison, which is clear to anyone whose lawn has dead spots from nitrogen-rich dog pee. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing. Ozone pollution also works in a town tree's favor, if in a backhanded way. When I came across a study in Nature claiming that ozone causes young city trees to grow faster than country trees, I was doubtful. Ground-level ozone, formed when my car exhaust reacts with sunlight, is good for trees? I had thought it burned their leaves the way it burns human lung tissue. On a closer reading, I found that ozone is indeed bad for trees. But the reaction that turns exhaust to ozone takes some time, so when I start my car, my exhaust flows harmlessly past my oak tree. Sunlight works on the chemicals as they drift on the wind, out of town, and up the coast. By the time my exhaust filters through a stand of seaside spruce, it's ripe and reactive. The wild trees bear the brunt of my city driving. They grow more slowly. It's not that the city air grows healthy trees. It just grows less sick trees. A tree's life on the lawn does have some drawbacks. Urban air carries soot and other dusts that jam open the stomate pores of a leaf, which prevents them from closing to hold in moisture. City air is also a few degrees warmer than rural air, which causes trees to release more water to cool off. On the bright side, the heat can stretch a tree's growing season. Urban soils also handicap trees. The soil through which their roots chase nutrition is often junk. The flavor of the garbage varies from place to place, but common varieties include acid soil from acid rain, alkaline soil from the disintegration of concrete sidewalks and foundation, compacted soil from feet and tires, waterproofed soil from the wax trees secrete on their leaves in response to pollution, and microbe poor soil that produces tree food slowly. One of the saddest deprivations town trees weather is the loss of some little buddies who ought to be growing along their roots. Mycorrhizal fungi are symbionts who web out from tree roots to do the yeoman's labor of hunting down nourishment. In addition to feeding their tree, they also seem to protect trees from drought, and they condition the soil into the perfect size of crumb. In exchange for all these services, the trees send carbohydrates down to feed its fungi. Various investigations have found that town trees lead a rather lonesome existence in this regard. They may be accompanied by some fungi, but not the diversity of species that rural trees enjoy. Lots of other plants also get assistance from mycorrhizal fungi, but trees need the fungi so badly that you can buy them in a can to augment urban dirt. The durability of this cure is questionable. Science suggests that the fungi may need clean soil if they're to stick around. Despite its mistreatment, my oak tree offers goods and services worth thousands of dollars, not least are its aesthetic labors. By mid-October, trees across the state are closing down for the winter, and leaf peepers are spending hundreds of millions to watch this colorful contraction. My own yard is like a painting that evolves every day. A few forsythia leaves shift from a lime color to deep purple. The sumac leaves grade from green to yellow, then orange, then scarlet, blazing like red stars. On the chokecherry, the leaf hues are an assortment of peach and avocado. In the bamboo wilderness, bittersweet vines turn lemony. The oak is a late bloomer, offering only a few red leaves. It will hold its dead brown leaves until a November storm flails them away. The foliage display of northern trees was long thought to be a side effect of the trees shutting down their energy production. As the green chlorophyll degrades in the leaves, yellow and red pigments, that were there all along, come to light. So went the theory. But I've recently come across a few papers suggesting the color has a function of its own. One of the clues is that the red anthocyanins don't flood leaves until late summer, and anthocyanins function as sunscreen, antifreeze, and antioxidant. One theory, then, is that the red chemicals prolong the life of an old leaf, giving it more time to drain its nutrients into the tree. A second theory is that trees use color to warn away enemy insects seeking a tree to host their eggs for the winter. The healthiest trees make the brightest leaves, this theory goes, signaling to insects that their kids will meet a vigorous chemical defense when they hatch and start feeding in the spring. One paper has found a correlation between the brightest fall trees and the least insect damage the following year, but a correlation isn't proof of cause and effect. The red leaf mystery isn't resolved. Whatever their reason, the deciduous trees in my yard spend a few weeks making themselves gorgeous before they shed their leaves altogether. My oak tree performs practical tasks as well. In summer, its leaves prevent the sun from beating on my house. That reduces my need for air conditioning. Its crown casts a shadow within which it can be 30 degrees cooler than the unshaded lawn. My tree also soaks up dangerous pollutants like ozone and volatile chemicals and neutralizes them. At this very moment, the oak is trapping microscopic dust particles that inflame human lungs, and its growth is soaking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, countering what my car emits. Although the carbon stored in the leaves will rise to overheat the globe again when the leaves decompose, the trunk and branches are taking carbon out of circulation for centuries. The tree is even transferring some carbon down into the soil for long-term storage. Lately, some tree lovers have attempted to put a dollar figure on the work city trees do. Accounting methods vary, with some studies looking only at the value of reducing pollution, and others trying to tack a figure on the aesthetic value of a tree. A Chicago tree, for instance, is judged to save $402 a year in pollution abatement and air conditioning costs. For every dollar spent on a tree in Modesto, California, the tree will return $1.89 in air cleaning and cooling services, and by raising property values. In New York, a small honey locust tree earns $637 a year through pollution control and landscape value. An enormous tulip tree earns $23,069. A big tree like my oak, with its thousands of leaves, is 60 to 70 times better at air cleaning than a small tree. On that basis, my half-grown oak might be doing $10,000 worth of pollution control and beautification this year. But that's still a narrow view of the tree's worth. My pines, for instance, stand between the house and the north wind, reducing my need to burn fossil fuels in the winter. The oak obligingly drops its leaves just when the house is in need of solar beams in the winter. My trees release oxygen, which I inhale. When it rains, the tree slows the drops, increasing the percentage of water that sinks into the soil. Their leaves, both on the branch and on the ground, muffle the sounds of humanity around me. The terpenes that my pines release on a hot day give the air a priceless spice. The real value of my trees is too complex for me to characterize. I wouldn't want to live without them. None of these value your tree studies considers the value of a tree to animals either. To my birds, trees are insect cafes, resting spots, and sentry posts. The crows even derive recreational value from the apple tree, which offers a bumper crop of dead branches to yank, peck, and twirl in the beak. The squirrels rely on my trees for protection, scrabbling up the nearest trunk when they're alarmed. They also make their leafy drays and their baby nursing nests high in the trees. My young pines are too short to offer much, beside the usual complement of insects, but the neighbor's pine has sheltered a nest of crow eggs in the past. The bleached sticks and grasses of an old nest are spilling slowly down the trunk. Fruit from my oak and apple tree feed everyone from mice to microbes, plowing nutrients back into the yard. And, of course, the trees make chipmunk food. Not that I have need of that by mid-autumn. Cheeky is here one day, and the next day he's not. He's not hibernating. Chipmunks don't hibernate. And anyway, it's too warm for him to begin a winter cycle of long naps. Cheeky has not relocated. Chipmunks don't walk away from their investment in a tunnel system and a stuffed larder. I'm also troubled to note that I have seen no sharp-shinned hawk hunting the neighborhood of late, on the list of possible explanations for my chipmunk's disappearance. This leaves cats. Once again, I seem to have lost a friend to a neighbor's pet. For 3 weeks I continue to leave the back door open and a cup of seeds on Cheeky's stool in the kitchen. Every time I pass the cup, I check to see if anything's missing. When the weather turns raw, I close the door, but leave the seeds just on the other side. I open it frequently to check for missing seeds. Whenever I cross the yard, I stop by his main hole and tell myself that the apple leaf at the entrance has a fresh paw print on it. or that it has moved a half an inch. The spicy scent of yarrow in the lawn, or of sunflower seeds, evokes a memory of the way his fur smelled. I miss the heft of him in my palm, and the warmth of that coppery velvet against my cheek. But Cheeky never comes again. He was the only chipmunk I've ever seen at this house. Given the number of other people's cats who trespass in my yard, maybe that's not surprising. My yard may also be deficient in the ideal chippy food. Researching the relationship between trees and rodents, I discover that while chipmunks certainly welcome acorns, they are even more delighted with red maple seeds. Come spring, I'll be planting a maple tree. It will muffle noise and mop up pollution. It'll reduce water runoff, and it might even look nice. Who cares? I just want to feed the chipmunks. Chapter 9. Sifting Secrets from the Air. I think this is the first autumn that I've ever been happy to see tree branches turn bare. For months it's been a struggle to watch what's going on in the yard. Insects molted and matured, birds nested and fledged, squirrels built summer beds, all behind a screen of leaves. Now I can see again. On the morning after the oak relinquishes its garnet leaves, I find the crows lined up on their begging branch. How many mornings have they sat there, hidden by leaves, wondering, "Where's the dimwit with the dog food?" Happy to see them so sharp and glossy against the sky, I rustle up their grub. When I step out of the door, cold air makes me cough. The sky is so clear, it looks as though a crow could shatter it with a peck. Before I set a foot on the lawn, I sense that frost has stiffened the soil. Maybe sounds are bouncing differently across this rigid world. Even my startled nose detects a change. Gone is the mélange of industrious greenery and toiling soil. In its place is a delicate odor of dryness. The cold night to come is even more brittle. The stars blaze clear and white. A blowing leaf rattles like ice on a window pane. Winter is in the air. What does that mean, I wonder? What does air do so differently from one season to the next? Not so long ago, the air carried enough heat and moisture to drive itself mad. In July, I cowered on the deck as air boiled into thunderheads. A wedge of cold air was plowing south from Canada. It rammed under the local warm air, boosting it skyward. The displaced air churned and roiled until it built a load of ice balls and electricity it could no longer contain. At 2 on a sweltering afternoon, the world goes dusky. From the northwest, thunder grumbles. Hot wind rushes around the yard like a rabbit. Leaves slap and thrash. Tree swallows chitter high overhead, surfing on a sea of gas. Their black silhouettes against clouds the color of a bruise. Thunder grumbles closer. I count the seconds. 2 miles. A blue jay calls, unperturbed by the lowering sky. The darkness deepens, and rain arrives in bursts. Yawp, my naughty crow, wheels past and tries to land on a foot-long branch at the top of the neighbor's spruce tree. Under his weight, the skinny stick bends and points to the ground. Growling, Yawp climbs onto the upright leader, which accommodates him by bending into the horizontal plane. But the leader is bouncy, the wind is buffety, and Yawp flails. He soon quits and flies to the big silver maple. There the whole family gathers. Then they swoop together into the midsection of the south neighbor's tall pine. They work their way in to huddle near the trunk. The need for shelter has trumped the need for surveillance. A flash glares over the trees, and 5 seconds later, sound waves ripple across the yard. Rumble, bumble, bumble. 1 mile and closing. A tall, white fork stabs the planet west of me. A bolt slaps left to right, cloud to cloud. Smack, crack. There's little rain to dim the light show. Yawp, hungry and bored, or awed at nature's spectacle, yawps tentatively from inside the pine tree. Then, less tentatively, Yop, 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 yop. Then comes a noise like a giant throwing a punch through a stack of windows. The clouds, which now seem to brush my chimney, crash, snap, and roar around the crows and me and the songbirds who hop deep into their own trees and bushes. A solitary cardinal remains on the outer limbs of the chokecherry tree, fluttering and grooming in the thickening raindrops. Overhead, hooves gallop hither and yon. A spark splits into three prongs that skewer the earth. Whack! The cardinal retreats into the chokecherry, and the fire siren down the street commences wailing. For my part, I recollect my intention to refresh the old fire extinguisher. It's the kind of chore you only remember when nature toys with the idea of burning your house. The rain arrives, drilling into the ground and driving up the smell of damp dust. The world goes gray and water rushes down, hissing like a waterfall. The topography of the clouds is blotted out. Lightning becomes a muted flicker. Harder and harder the rain hammers. Behind the rain, thunder shudders like a freight train bearing down on the house. A huge energy churns up there. Lightning that strikes a mile away triggers a ripple of gas molecules that drum on my chest. A fire truck leaves the barn across the way as fresh wailing rises from the downtown. Then, after just 10 minutes of cataclysm, the rain calms. The flash and rumble move downwind over the ocean. The crows emerge from the spruce tree while sparse rain still falls. They fly into the tall trees and have a big talk. Then they glide down to North Neighbor's yard, where they hunker in the grass, bobbing and fluttering to splash water on their backs. They extend their wings and let the last raindrops pelt them. Yop stands up and approaches a bathing adult. Yop! He is pecked at. He bounds to his next victim. Yop! The air is thick. A fungus scholar once told me that rain causes fungus spore pouches to burst and releases gazillions of spores into the air, and that the smell of baby fungi is mistaken for the smell of clean air. Thus come the summer rains. They're all we get, really, these flashy downpours. They're often insufficient to keep tomato plants from wilting and grass from going dormant. This is one of those years. The more substantial storms have migrated north for the summer, along with the jet stream that escorted them around the planet. We're left with the weekly thunderstorm, whose rain falls so fast the soil can't absorb it before it rolls away downhill. Maine. The way life should be. A sign bearing this motto greets visitors entering the state on the turnpike. Some people might quibble over the high dioxin content of lobster livers, or the acreage clear-cut by paper companies, but even those people would have to admit that most of the state smells the way life should smell. All the greenery helps, pines especially, release perfumey molecules into the air. The scarcity of heavy industry helps, too, but in my yard the most delicious smell comes up from the ocean. The air in every corner of the planet smells a little different. My corner smells best. Following the storm, the cool northern air dominates for a while. It's flavored with the breath of 1,000 miles of forest it filtered through en route from Canada. I take out an atlas to see what else this air might have gathered. Immediately upwind from my yard is Portland Harbor, where cargo and cruise ships belch diesel soot. Beyond the harbor, the smell of scorching coffee beans rises from the cafes of the old port. A pinch of coffee soot is probably drifting across my yard now. Continuing northwest, I encounter the hometown of a paper mill and the garbage incinerator that converts my trash to more soot, gas, and ash. Perhaps my old vinyl shower curtain is returning to me on the wind as dioxin. Then it's out to farm country, where the air would have loaded up on pollens and soil dust, fragments of dry cow dung, fertilizer and pesticides, and the fragrance of table flowers and squash blossoms. When the cold air came across Sebago Lake, it might have gathered the glassy shells of diatoms from the shore. Beyond that, the hills begin, mounding up to the White Mountains in New Hampshire. There the spruce and hardwoods threw in their 2 cents worth of chemicals, or even 4 cents worth. Some plants release extra defense compounds when they're wind buffeted. The bare mountaintops surely gave a few grains of granite dust to the rushing air, along with a whiff of radon gas. The great north woods come next, offering mile after mile of tree molecules. And Canada beyond is just as green, clear up to the thinning stubble of the taiga, where mosses and dwarf willow tickle the belly of the wind. And now all that air is coasting through my neighborhood. Unfortunately, the summer wind often arrives from a less pure quarter. In mid-August, a more typical pattern holds sway, with hot air coming out of the west. Down at the beach one morning, I look out to Peaks Island, on whose shore the houses usually stand like neat boxes. The island is a gray mound, fuzzed with smog. Out over the ocean, the smog forms a layer the hue of a tobacco stain. Back at home, my radio issues an ozone warning. Particle counts are climbing, too. This air wasn't cooked up in any forest. Much of it was dished out by the coal-fired electricity plants in the Midwest, which leak sulfur and nitrogen, mercury and carbon. This waste evolved as it migrated from the Midwestern smokestacks to my yard. The summer sun baked it into ozone and a damp stew of acidic particles. Now that it has reached my neighborhood, we're instructed to stay indoors and close the windows. My crows and the squirrels and the oak and apple trees don't have the option of hiding from the gunk. They breathe what they're given. Maine, the way Ohio should be. On the best days, though, the farmland and the forests of inland Maine heat and rise. This sets up a dynamic, like water flowing through a drain. The sticky air from my yard flows toward the inland drain, and to replace my departing air, cool air flows in from over the ocean. Sometimes it announces itself with wisps of sea fog that evaporate even as they limp down the street. Other times the fruity air arrives with no visible herald. Occasionally it comes at night, pushing through the screens and filling the dark house. However it arrives, it always smells like tomato leaves and watermelon and seaweed and briny little life forms and mud and summer. It's divine. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn, by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.